Roger Green, host of the Surfing the Mesh Tsunami podcast. This week, we're offering 6 conversations from episode 7, where we join 5 leading North American patient advocates to celebrate the approval of Rezdiffra on March 14th, 2024, and to discuss some implications for patients and other stakeholders. For the most part, this conversation focuses on defining the target patient population and then finding these patients. It starts with me asking the group how the current set of target patients are defined and why the number is 315,000. Jeff McIntyre makes the point that these are the patients currently treated for F2 or F3 MASH somewhere in the U.S. healthcare system. I ask if this is analogous to the idea of warehouse patients observed in hepatitis C. Jeff suggests these are quite different in that warehouse patients were not being treated at all while awaiting a therapy, whereas all the target MASH patients are engaged in some form of treatment today. Next, I note that Wayne Eskridge published a long post earlier in the day about the extensiveness of the Madrigal Patient Support Program. Wayne discusses this program in some detail, in the process explaining why this process appears likely to be more engaged and more interactive and more helpful than typical patient support programs. In episodes 6 and 7, we have now spoken to 2 of the groups most directly engaged in activities leading to and emanating from the Rezdiffra approval. This group of patient advocates is energized, optimistic, and brimming with new ideas. So just sit back, listen, enjoy, learn, and when you're done, join the dialogue in our LinkedIn discussion group. I've heard the number 300,000 to 400,000 a couple of times. My impression is that there are more F2s and F3s in America than simply that many. So where does the number come from? Please do explain to our audience. I mean, Jeff's used it with me. Tony used it just right now. Where did the number come from? And what is the next population? Because going back to Jen's point, the population of treatable patients is broader than that, or should be broader than that for a drug like this once the system's in place to handle it. So where does the number come from? And who does it leave out that might be included or thought of more expansively over time?
Jeff McIntyre.
Roger, for me, that number comes from an estimate of patients in the system right now. And so when we look at patients in the system, probably, you know, looking, as you said, F2, F3, that's currently diagnosed in the system and theoretically receiving some sort of care of some sort for some sort of additions. That's going to be very different than kind of what I see the next step as being, as working with providers to identify patients. Because I think that there's a large group that has this, as you say, it's going to be way over that number, but that have not been identified. And I think that there are places where now, that's part of where the hope comes from, is now we can start that process to identify, to better categorize, and be able to get them medication and treatment that's going to be helpful in this way.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. I mean, when they talk about, a lot of times, first drug gets approved for a disease, they talk about patients that are warehoused. Would this be analogous to what you would describe as a warehouse patient population? Or is it, since it was nothing to do, everybody that has this disease and is in the system, we know how to track?
Yeah, that's a harsh term for me, because I feel like there's so many co-occurring disorders that happen with this, and the symptomology is so complex, the notion that the patients are being warehoused kind of indicates that they're just being put aside for the moment. And I don't think that is the case. I think what we've got are patients with, you know, when we look at this disease state, you know, F3 to F4 can be kind of fuzzy. So how do you get the treatment there for that? When does that moment of fibrosis occur? F1 into F2 equally can be kind of fuzzy. I mean, we're not talking about black and white states in this way. And so warehousing sounds a little harsh to me in that regard, because I do think that with patients that are identified that are in the healthcare system right now, that's largely because they are receiving some sort of treatment. They have been identified and or maybe going through clinical trials, you know, as a means of hope for trying to address this. They are probably struggling or trying to attempt some sort of behavioral change with physical activity and nutrition. And so I think this is where the true hope comes in this, is that it allows for the ability to now take a next step and something to address, you know, the specific stage of NASH, while also, as Jen said, doing it in conjunction with, as the label indicates, the other treatments that they're already engaged with.
Mike Battelle.
Yeah, question for Jeff. Maybe he knows, or if someone else knows here too. Patients that may have received the placebo but not the active drug in another study, or patients that had an active drug that didn't respond, that might be included in there as well, right? Would that be included? Would that number be included as part of the number that Roger was quoting?
I believe that to be the case, yes.
I suspect that's right, Mike.
Louise Campbell.
I think the figures were shown by Madrigal at the press conference come from the, because I've pulled it up here, the euphoria in claims data, and it was presented 7th to 10th of May 2023 Boston. And they showed a diagram that basically filters in of 1.5 million people diagnosed with NASH. Diagnosed with NASH moderate to advanced fibrosis was the 525,000. And further down, there were 315,000 diagnosed moderate to advanced disease and seen by the 14,000 specialists. So they demonstrated that quite well. And I think that accounts for everybody, because you can't cherry pick out of that who's been enrolled to a study, who's not been included, who's not. So to answer that question, Michael, it never demonstrates who's already been treated within a clinical trial. But I think the term warehousing, I would agree with Jeff. It was something that was coined in the hepatitis C era, particularly for the direct antivirals. And that was because there was a treatment that was worse in the context of long-term side effects. We did not want to start genotype 1s or 4s on a year's worth of treatment coming into the approvals for, obviously, Gilead at that time. That was a patient choice. If the patient still wished to carry on to go for interferon therapies, because we were strong believers, right place, right drug, right time, the patient decides that. But a lot of patients held off. And that's where the term that I'm particularly familiar with, warehousing, comes from, because we had a better advantage coming. So I don't think that's the case here. I think there was nothing there. We have to manage comorbid conditions. And we know a lot of patients with NASH are not optimized on their comorbidity conditions and medications. And I think we can still strengthen that. We still need to strengthen that in light of resmetirom approval.
So thank you. I got that question about warehousing three times between Thursday and today and didn't have a really good answer for it. I know it came from Hep C. So I just figured I'd throw it out to you guys. One of you guys would to help me look smarter the next time the question showed up. And I think you've done a really good job of that. So we know what it feels like as patients. How does it change the work of advocates? I mean, Wayne, you put out a letter on this today about things that Madrigal were doing and how to collaborate with them. I'd love for you to take a minute and share with our audience, most of which probably doesn't read the fatty, your newsletter or your personal letters, about kind of what you were talking about. And then, by the way, how they can find you so that they can stay informed, because I think what you put out every week is really good.
Wayne Eskridge.
Well, thanks, Roger. We've collaborated a fair amount with Madrigal over the years. There's a goal on their part, I believe, and it's genuine, to really deliver excellent patient support and patient care and access to the drug longer term. And as part of that, they've developed a patient support portal, that's something that a lot of firms produce, but ordinarily those are links to PDF files and, you know, some links to additional services that people can find. The thing that Madrigal is doing is they're actually building a staff which is charged with helping patients solve the problems of access that they have. So in theory, if someone is unable to get the prescription, or they're unable to deal with their payers, or they're unable to find financial support, that this staff will assist the patient directly and assist them as more like navigators for liver transplant, perhaps, and not just as a portal for PDF information. And we really salute that, because as we go into this whole process, it's a complex thing, and it's going to be very easy for patients to become confused and misdirected and feel stymied as to what's available and what's not. So I really commend Madrigal for that. And, you know, if people want to follow up with us, go to thefattyliverfoundation.org and just give us your email, and we'll keep you on the mailing list for our blogs.
And now, back to Roger.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. If you have any questions or comments about the content of this conversation or the entire episode, please put them in the review section of the page from which you downloaded this conversation, or send an email to questions@surfingmash.com. We're still working on next week's topic, but it will be a good one. All the options are great. Until then, stay safe, surf on, see you on the podcast. Bye-bye now.